men I'm telling you, I keep this money.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Monday, January 23rd, 2012. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this evening, we're talking with Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia. Peter is a writer who writes for the New York Star Ledger. He also writes for Critcherland on Fridays and Masterwork Broadway on Tuesdays. And Peter, you have a new column that you're doing with MTI, which we call it MTI, but we should say it's Music Theatre International, isn't it?
Yes, Music Theatre International licenses musicals to schools, community theaters, even pro theaters. So their catalog includes a lot of hits like Hairspray, Avenue Q, Spring Awakening. Most of the new ones are with MTI. So yes, I'm going to be doing columns for them. I started doing one this week on a marvelous thing I saw in Atlanta, the Junior Theater Festival, which is where kids from middle schools come from all around the country. I mean, there was even a school from Casper, Wyoming. And they perform 15-minute excerpts from musicals. And it's really just great to see all these kids doing so well there. So I'm delighted to be reporting on that. There was so much happened. It had to be in four parts. So only the first part is up as of now. But more's coming, I promise.
That's great. I'm so excited to hear that stuff. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, MTI, did Andrew Lloyd Webber invest in that, or is that...
No, I know he has shows with Rodgers and Hammerstein, so Rodgers I never heard that.
It
was company
MTI
actually
is...
started by Frank Lesser, actually, started the company way back when, but now it's owned by Freddie Gershon. But boy, he really has put his heart and soul into that company. He's made a lot of innovative moves, so I think anybody who rents shows will tell you that MTI is one of the great companies to go to when you want to rent a show.
That's right. I forgot Rodgers and Hammerstein, Andrew Lloyd Webber. That's right. MTI, Cameron McIntosh, or I can't remember. But anyway, not that it matters. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and photographer. You can see his writing and photography at BroadwayStars.com. You can see his writing at other places such as the Sondheim Review. You could see, Matt, NPR this week. You had a piece on NPR, Michael. Is that correct?
Yes, I interviewed Petula Clark, who's going to be at Feinstein's starting tomorrow for 2 weeks, I think. I'm not sure exactly, but she's
tomorrow,
going to be there.
Tuesday the 24th.
Yeah, yeah.
Great. Excellent. So welcome, everybody. The two of you had the opportunity to see Porgy and Bess. Peter, why don't you give us an intro on Porgy and Bess, and what did you think about this production?
Well, the first thing that really tickled my fancy was the fact that for all the talk about the show being the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, the show curtain simply says Porgy and Bess. So there seemed that, I don't know if people just didn't think to put the Gershwin's name on the show curtain, but there it is. When you walk in to the Richard Rogers Theaters, that's what you're going to see. So, of course, no show, considering what this one has gone through in terms of tryout, not on stage but off stage, could possibly live up or live down everything that's been said about it. So I found it a pleasant evening. I wasn't crazy about it. I didn't hate it. I thought the people in it were good. I enjoyed the performances. It was great hearing that music again. Yeah, I missed the Buzzard song, as everybody else will tell you who knows the score. But all in all, you know, I thought it was a very nice rendition of Porgy and Bess. Now, some may say, well, nice is not the word you should be using with Porgy and Bess. You should be overwhelmed by it. You should come out of there in tears and all that. No, it didn't quite work that way for me. But an acceptable evening. Audrey McDonald, yes, quite fine. I wish that they didn't put a scar on her face, because I think that really hurts the character. I mean, she is still the object of affection of many men. And I really do believe that a lot of men would discount her if she had this big scar in her face, that she would be damaged goods and they would look elsewhere. Because it really is quite a scar. When she first came on, I thought it was the microphone, but then I realized it was not. It was indeed the scar. So poor Norm Lewis, here he is. You know, everybody talked about the fact that he's not on a go-kart and he walks with a cane. Well, what wasn't made clear to me is that it isn't just he's walking with a cane. He has to twist his leg into a terrible position when he walks, and it must be just god-awful to have to go through that so many times a week. Ironically enough, two nights in a row I saw somebody have trouble with legs, and the other one was Richard III out at BAM, where Kevin Spacey is even more tortured in the way that that he walks. And I gave a lot of thought to Lagos Egri's book. Do you know this book, The Art of Dramatic Writing, when he talks about some people with handicaps overcome them and some people with handicaps don't? You know, they're mad at the world while other people say, I'm going to make the best of it. And I thought of that while watching Porgy and Bess, because Porgy really is as much at home with his disability as he possibly can be. Well, and to be fair to Richard, it's not just that he limps. I mean, the hump can't make you a happy-go-lucky person either. I mean, to be fair. But nevertheless, it must be torturous to have to walk that way night after night after night. People have talked to me about Norm Lewis not having the right voice for the role. I thought it was a fine theater voice. Audrey McDonald's was more than that. Yes, I'll grant you that. The other thing that occurred to me while watching this, and I hope this isn't offensive to anybody, but this is really in the published script of Golden Boy, that William Gibson talks about the fact that Sammy Davis Jr., when this 1964 musical about a black boxer in love with a white woman was coming together, said to Strauss and Adams, write colored, please write colored, meaning I don't want it to sound like it's a white score. And boy, you know, once again, you have to really appreciate what George Gershwin did. You don't need me to tell you that, really. But nevertheless, that music, I think, really does have that ethnic feel to it. And he really stretched himself on this one, which is news to nobody at all. The one thing that this production has that it certainly didn't have in 1935 were all the woos that the audience gave it. And I was thrilled to see the audience be so enthusiastic about it. So maybe Porgy and Bess will be a nice Broadway hit. I wish it well. For me, sat there, let it wash over me, walked in, enjoyed it, walked out.
All right, Michael, what was your take on this? All righty, we're moving on. Okay.
I despised the production. Ah. Yeah. I would say, Peter said it's acceptable. I would say it's unacceptable. I wrote a review. I didn't actually do a word count, but I think it's probably about 2,000 words because I do know the original so well, and I thought it would be useful to go through it almost moment by moment and catalog exactly the changes and additions and cuts that have been made, just for the record. And as I said to someone earlier, although I certainly express my opinion at various points during the review, much of it is really just listing what they've done. And I think that alone will give an indication of how fully they've really destroyed, almost destroyed, what Gershwin and George Gershwin and Ira Gershwin and DuBose Hayward, whose name is nowhere on the new title of this show, created. I would direct you to my review because I really could talk for an hour and I'll just make myself upset and you know, maybe say things I shouldn't. A few things. And this surprised me. I did not even like Audra McDonald's performance, which has been almost universally praised, other than by me. I think that she's playing a character that is not the character that was written, and she's also playing it in a style that is not appropriate for musical theater or for certainly not for opera. She's playing in a very gritty, realistic, internal style that just is not what it's called for. And I mean, at one point, there's a lot of spoken dialogue in this version, as you may have heard. And I literally, if I didn't know the words she was saying, because I know the piece so well, I would not have been able to understand what she was saying. This was in the scene where, right after she recovers from being, in this version, well, normally, as written, Bess is raped, basically, by her former lover, Crown, when she goes off to a picnic on Kittiwa Island and gets lost. In this version, he starts to attack her or force himself on her. She fights him off for about 3 or 4 minutes. And then at the end, she suddenly stands back and goes, "Come on, come on," and indicates that he should follow her into the underbrush and, you know, screw her there. I guess they did this, you know, for some ridiculous, politically correct reading that she's taking ownership of her own rape, or that Audrey McDonald didn't want to be raped on stage, so she wants to make it look like she's in control for that moment. But at any rate, then the next scene, she comes back to Catfish Row and she's literally almost catatonic. She's mumbling like someone in an insane asylum. And it didn't make any sense. And that was the scene. The scene following that one was where she was mumbling so badly that I really couldn't understand what she was saying. Also, on top of that, both she and Norm Lewis are singing in a style that is not what the music was written to sound like. They're putting in all these pauses, all this back phrasing, playing with the note values, the rhythms and the pitches, speaking words. That's not what it's supposed to sound like. It's supposed to be "Porky, how's your woman now?" It's not supposed to be "Porky, how's your woman now?" It's just not supposed to be that. And it ruins these beautiful, beautiful songs. So I was very tremendously disappointed in her, especially because I would have expected better from her. The direction is horrendous. The rewrites of the dialogue are not so awful, but completely unnecessary. They're certainly not an improvement over the original. The orchestrations are don't even begin to approach the original Gershwin orchestrations. It should be noted that Gershwin did orchestrate the original version himself. Musical theater composers rarely orchestrate their own shows for a number of reasons. Opera composers almost always do. So there's obviously an authenticity in the Gershwin orchestrations that is not here. And it is especially ironic, given this new title that they've given it, the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, that they've taken such a major, major part of it out. I could go on and on, but I would direct you to my review. One general comment, though, is this. Norm Lewis also is not playing Porgy as written. He comes on as he seems very surly, very angry. You couldn't believe that he doesn't seem like he's part of the community. You can't understand why anyone would like him. That's not the character that's written. I think that that's part and parcel what he's doing here and what Audra's doing and what Patti LuPone did in Gypsy to a certain extent, just to pick one example offhand, is that some people, when they do revivals, they feel like they have to, first of all, they feel like they have to do it differently than it's been done before, even if the way it was done before was the right way to do it. You know, you can understand why in a way, but isn't that kind of counterproductive? It doesn't really make much sense. If you have to go against the character as written in order to do something different, I just think that's crazy. And another thing is that some people today seem to feel like that they need to bring this much more realistic, gritty kind of internal acting into musical theater because they think it's quote unquote better. Well, it's not better. It's just a different style of acting that is not appropriate for musical theater, especially not on Broadway. I mean, maybe if you did a chamber musical in a 100 seat off-Broadway theater, that might be different depending on the kind of show and the kind of score. But to play Porgy and Bess, you know, like it's Mamet or a Spike Lee movie, I just think that's insane. So I'm terribly, terribly disgusted, frankly, by this production. And you can say that, you know, the original opera will always survive. I think it will. But I hate to think that this will have any kind of a life anywhere, and that people will see this and think this is Porgy and Bess. And I hope they decide not to license it, but I don't know if there's any possibility of that. I hope that there is a possibility of that.
Well, a lot of companies do license two versions of things. Tams Whitmark has two different versions of Charlie Brown, and I believe If Anything Goes as well. So it might be all right. I guess not with you, Michael, but to have two different versions for people who can't afford to do a grand opera version. This is Porgy and Bess Light. There's no question about that.
Right, right.
So maybe it's better for people to see some Porgy and Bess than no Porgy and Bess at all. You may disagree, and I understand that.
Well, I do, because, I mean, I understand that argument. And, I mean, it's certainly conceivable that some people will see this and want to seek out the original version in one form or another. Mm-hmm. I would direct them to there's a video of the Glyndebourne production that Trevor Nunn directed. This is his of the full opera, not the musical version that he did a few years ago in London. Although that production has its flaws, it certainly is, you know, 8 million times better than this one, in my view, and much, much, much closer to the original. It's got the original orchestrations. It's almost completely uncut. So that is what I would direct you to for a video. That's really your only option, because the film, although it has its good points, also has many flaws and many cuts, and also is unavailable. But you also do have the option of three complete recordings, at least, the best of which is a three CD set on RCA of the Euston Grand Opera production that played on Broadway in 76 with Klamath Dale.
Did you see it, Michael?
I did. I'm so glad I did. I'll never forget.
I did too. You know, twice, in fact. So, there's no question that's the superior of the two productions. And I don't think anybody would deny otherwise.
As to your other point, Peter, the thing is that, I don't think it's a bad idea necessarily to try to create a version of Porgy and Bess that could be done more as a musical with the resources that a musical theater company rather than an opera company would have. But I don't think that's necessarily a bad idea. But this one, I mean, there are so many arbitrary changes in the lyrics and the dialogue and it that it's not what it could have been. I believe that the version that played on Broadway in 42, which was the first, basically the first revival, was apparently sort of like a musical, because they cut a great deal of the sung dialogue, and it was played with a reduced orchestra. You know, you could do Porgy and Bess with a 22-piece orchestra, you know, and still approximate the original orchestrations. You wouldn't have as many instruments on each part, but it would still, you know, the harmonies would be there, and it would make the point. And the choral parts have also been rewritten in this one, and this is interesting. I looked really hard in the playbill, and I could not see any credit for the new choral arrangement. So that's a little weird. Maybe nobody wanted to take credit for them. Presumably it's Deirdre Murray, but she is not specifically credited with the new choral arrangements. So I really despised it.
Off on a tangent here, that reminds me of the 1983 revival of On Your Toes, because when I was researching for my MVP book, I was thinking about making George Abbott the comeback player of the year. But, you know, I mean, on the other hand, he was he was a pretty old man by that point. And did he really do anything? I mean, was it a case that, like Busby Berkeley in the 71 No No Nanette production did nothing? I mean, it was all Bert Shevlov. He wasn't able to do it. And was it a case that George Abbott wasn't able to come through for that On Your Toes revival? And looking at the playbill, what I noticed was there was an assistant this and an assistant that and all these, you know, assistant costume designer. Everybody had an assistant, and there's no assistant director listed. Well, I happened to run to John Marcheri, who was working on that production. I said, hey, you know, did Abbott really do On Your Toes? Yes, he certainly did. I said, well, didn't he have an – I don't see any assistant director. He didn't need an assistant. He didn't want one. Well, actually, he did have an assistant who went out and got him a chicken sandwich and coffee every day at lunch. But that was it. You know, otherwise he did the show, you know. So I'm reminded of that when you say you're looking for an assistant's name in that program and you can't find one. So that's
well, the orchestrations are credited to and so therefore you would think that the choral arrangements would be, because they're very different from the originals, but they really are not. You know, I don't know.
I don't know. I went to this with, you know, really the feeling that the well had been poisoned on this show. And as a result, you know, I made my peace with it pretty early on. I wonder, do you know if the set's been changed since Boston? I've heard that it had been. A friend of mine in Boston, who was as apoplectic as you, Michael, about the show, I must point out, said, and the set looks like two toilet paper rolls. Well, whatever was going on up there at the Richard Rogers, it didn't look like two toilet paper rolls to me. I've got to talk to him about that. But
there are photos you can find, Peter. Okay. It did look quite different, but no more or less ugly.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not an attractive set, but of course, I guess people would argue Catfish Row isn't a very pleasant place.
It's also not very utilitarian. There's a scene where when Bess comes back from Kitty Waugh and she's deranged and they put her to bed. They put her to bed in the middle of the street. I mean, they put her to bed in a space that has always previously been used as the middle of the street. And it's been previously established that Porgy's room or whatever is off stage right, but suddenly she's lying down in the middle of the street with a blanket over her. So, you know.
Maybe this is taking unit set to a new low. Who knows? It could very well be.
Let me ask you a few questions. You've both talked about Audra and Norm, but did you guys talk about David and Alec Greer? Either one of you?
No.
Okay.
Go ahead, Michael.
Well, what the hilarious thing to me was for the first several minutes when he was on stage, I said, is he limping too? And I actually asked someone else, I said, what is that? And they said, I think it's just a strut. And I guess that's what it is. He does this incredibly exaggerated strut. I guess there's no other word for it. But for all the world, it looks to me like he's limping. Did it seem that way to you at all?
No, I can't say I noticed that at all. But and I'm not disproving what you're saying at all. I'm just saying I didn't notice that.
Well, maybe he's trying
to... He was more of a dandy to me than somebody who had really spent time in the trenches of Catfish Row.
Well, that's interesting. I thought he was less of a dandy than he's usually. I mean, he's supposed to be the guy who spends all his time in New York and just comes down to Catfish Row occasionally to sell drugs or whatever. But he's usually played and written, as far as I'm concerned, as, you know, this kind of guy who's like very, very faux charming, like a glad hand, like very obsequious and, you know, like really, really nasty underneath, but trying to like pretend that he's everybody's friend, you know, in order to get them high and get their money from them. He didn't do it that way. He was nasty from beginning to end. He never really seemed like he was having fun, even when singing those incredible, this really great lyrics that Ira Gershwin wrote for It Ain't Necessarily So. There was very, very little humor, in this show. And in fact, one of the worst moments, I think, got a laugh because even though it was silly and sophomoric, it was one of the few things that approached actual humor. Here they, the setup for I Got Plenty of Nothing is that Porgy is happy because he's finally getting laid. to put it frankly. I mean, that's specifically the point of the specific reason why he's happy, not because he was a very lonely man and suddenly this woman has come into his life that he's always loved from afar. So that to me was really kind of sophomoric, but it did get a big laugh because it sort of was humorous.
How about Nikki Renee Daniels?
I'm a big fan of Nikki, and I liked her very much in the way she sang Summertime. I thought she did a very nice job. How about you, Michael?
Yes, she was wonderful, and apparently, again, you know, we can only go by what we have read, but apparently when the show was in Cambridge, at least initially, Summertime was brought into a much lower key because, as Deirdre Murray had infamously said in an interview, she was going to bring the key down because she thought if it was sung in the normal soprano key, it would wake the baby. And by the way, I think they also had a real baby in Cambridge. And now they
do. Oh, I do remember hearing that. Yeah, I think you're right.
Again, you know, if it isn't broke, don't freaking fix it. Summertime has always been sung the first time by Clara alone. It's two verses and she sings both verses. In this version, they bring her husband into it, which you to sing to the baby too, which you might say, well, that's okay. What's wrong with that? But the thing is that in the next scene, Clara is still trying to quiet the baby and he's crying. And Jake says, isn't that child asleep yet? Give him to me. I'll take care of him. And he sings this upbeat, jazzy song called A Woman is a Sometime Thing. And it's supposed to be the contrast between how the mother tries to, you know, calm the child and how the father does it. And it's supposed to be, you know, amusing and sweet. But that contrast is gone now because he's already sung the lullaby too. So that's a kind of, you know, a minor example of the kind of needless changes that have been made here. I should mention, and I'm sure Peter will agree, I think he'll agree, that Philip Boykin, who plays Crown, is absolutely excellent. Very, very, very strong and a real presence, a magnificent voice. But one of the reasons he comes across so well is that his stuff has been much less severely tampered. There are some cuts, but it's not like there are all these rewrites, and I think the keys are basically the same, and even the orchestrations are somewhat the same for his stuff. And the same thing, too, for Mariah, the role of Mariah, which is played by Natasha Yvette Williams. She has a great number, which was written to be almost like a proto-rap number. It's spoken to music. And it's called I Hates Your Strutting Style, which she's dressing down sport and life for trying to get everyone high and ruining the community of Catfish Row. And it's very, very funny because she basically threatens him with a knife. And she gave a wonderful performance. And again, because they didn't feel it necessary to throw the baby out with the bathwater and rewrite all of her material.
All righty. So I guess we will see at the towards the end of the season if this the buzz that is about it has been very good. The ticket sales are very good. We'll see if it sustains and what happens here. Next up on our list is... both of you, I believe both of you got out to Paper Mill to see Boeing Boeing. Is that correct? Mm-hmm.
Same performance.
Same performance. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with Boeing?
It's a wonderful production directed by James Brennan, who is a very excellent director, in my opinion. I haven't seen him do too many shows, but the ones I've seen, every one of them has been first rate. And Boeing Boeing, which was revived on Broadway just a few years ago, is a very funny but very, very difficult comedy. I think a deceptively difficult one. It might seem easy, but the style of it has to be done just right. And also, this is one of those shows where the running time of the paper mill production with the intermission was 2.5 hours, which is sort of long for a comedy to begin with. But I swear, if they hadn't kept the pace up as wonderfully as they did in this production, I think it would have been closer to three. You have to keep it going at a breakneck pace, with obviously a certain moments where you pause. But for the most part, the energy just has to keep going and going. The slapstick in this production was brilliantly handled by the director and the actors. A lot of the humor in it is not in the lines itself, but in the delivery of the lines, and also extra, like little bits of extra business and vocal inflections that the cast and the director need to arrive at. And that was really, really excellent in this version. Beth Level was brilliant as the maid, Bertha. But the rest of the cast was equally strong. Someone I never heard of before, Matt Walton, played Bernard, the central character of this fellow who is stringing along these three airline stewardesses, basically, and romancing all three of them, and actually is engaged to all three of them. And he pulls this off because the three women are all on different timetables with their separate airlines, so they're never in Paris at the same time. And so as soon as he gets rid of, he spends like a day or a few hours with one, and as soon as she gets shuffled off, another one comes in. So it's very much a farce. There are literally slamming doors in it, a lot of that. But anyway, the role of Bernard is pretty much a straight man, but Matt Walton did a wonderful job with it. And the three stewardesses or air hostesses, it's interesting, even though the play is set in the mid-60s or early 60s, I don't think they're ever called stewardesses.
Right. And that surprised me because I had never really heard this term, air hostess. And I wonder if that's a British thing, It might very well be.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's a good point, Peter. Because actually the play was translated from, is it French or Italian?
Yeah, I believe French.
Yeah.
Well, on the other hand, Mark Camilletti is an Italian name. But I think of it as a French play. Maybe so many farces are French. Maybe it's that. But I got the impression that it was indeed a French play. Beverly Cross, who did the adaptation into English, is the book writer of Half a Sixpence, for people who remember a show of the same era as Boeing Boeing.
Yeah, I believe that even though Camilletti is obviously an Italian name, I think the play was written in French. But at any rate... I found that interesting that even in the early 60s, they weren't calling them stewardesses, but maybe as you say, it was because it was from the French. At any rate, the three women are played by Gloria is Heather Parcells, and Gabriella is Bryn O'Malley, and Gretchen is Anne Horak, and each one of them was fantastic. Tremendously exaggerated German, Italian, and New York accents, but done to a T and done really very, very well. And then, last but certainly not least, is John Shearer in the role of Robert, who is Bernard's friend, who sort of gets—he's this little nebbishy guy from Wisconsin who somehow gets caught up in all these sexual hijinks. And this was the role that Mark Rylance played in the most recent Broadway revival, and he was showered with praise because he did it so brilliantly. But John Shearer can certainly be very proud of his performance as well. Just loads and loads of laughs. I was conscious of very few, if any, laughs that were missed in this production. They got laughs where you wouldn't even think they would be able to. And again, I credit a great deal of that to James Brennan, who I wish would work more often, frankly.
All right, Peter, what'd you think?
I didn't like it at all.
Wow. So we're doing two for this.
Yeah, I know. I didn't really. Yeah, right. I don't like the play at all. And not because of the fact that we're dealing with a central character who's not being nice to women and being dishonest. It isn't even so much that. I just can't buy the setup. I mean, Bernard brags that he's got it all under control because he meticulously calculates each airline schedule. But can one really rely on airlines, three airlines, to land on time? I mean, what about delays? What about weather conditions? Now, you might say, but that's what happens. They all show up. You know, yeah, but given that so much time has passed for Bernard to romance and propose to all three ladies, one would expect that hell would have broken out a long time ago. So I have a problem with that. It's a big problem with believability. Now, yes, the doors do slam. But once someone's in a bedroom, and a lot of these ladies spend a lot of time off stage being in their bedrooms, none of these women hears the chaos going on in the living room. And considering that James Brennan keeps everyone screaming at decibels commensurate with rock concerts, the lady should overhear what's going on. Now, I know this happens in farce. I think all farces should be set in castles made of solid stone with thick doors made of logs, you know, so that's... it's also the type of play that nobody catches on that people are lying, and that's a big bugaboo with me. So, I mean, for example, after Bernard lies to one of his women, Brennan makes Robert so shocked that what he's been drinking erupts from his mouth and sprays the room. Okay. Under those circumstances, wouldn't the woman say, what's going on here? I mean, nobody does that in real life. That is an element of surprise that's taken over. Why doesn't anybody saying, you're lying? You know, why are they so stupid? And I think really it's almost like a type of ethnic slur on flight attendants, you know, that they thought it was so stupid. I mean, the hats that these poor girls have to wear are very right for the time. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not... chiding the set director, but they're silly hats, and it's almost like, you know, well, why should we give them good looking hats, because they have no brains anyway, so we might as well mock that. I do think that John Shearer is very good. He's very different from my Mark Rylance. It's a far less subtle performance, but this guy is so squeaky voiced and nervous that you can't even call him a milk toast. You have to call him a skimmed milk toast. He amuses with each eye roll, each gulp, as all his fuses are blown. I mean, he just has never been in a situation like this, and he's a good friend. He wants to protect his buddy. He wants him not to get caught. Not from a moral standpoint, it's just that he's a good friend, and he just... it's a good thing this was in the era when men carried handkerchief, because Shearer needs his quite often to mop his brow. He often has his hand over his heart, too, probably to see if it's still ticking. Matt Walton, he has the right brill-creamed button-down look, but he didn't make any impression on me, and the three women I thought were adequate. I mean, fine, you know, nothing wrong. They did the job. I didn't see them as anything more than that. However, yes, Beth Level, worth the price of admission. I mean, she got a laugh by the way she said the word done. I mean, you know, that's how do you get a laugh on that? She has this face that looks like she sucked a lemon throughout the entire show. And when she's dusting the furniture... The harsh way she swats each piece of furniture with a rag is like she's punishing it. And but oh, does she enjoy when all of Bernard's chicks come home to roost? You know, and I did too, because that meant the end of the play. So I mean, so I have issues with the play, and I know I'm being hard on farce. I know it's not supposed to be realistic, but for me, the best comedy is true comedy. The best comedy is comedy I can believe. I believe Flea in Her Ear. I do. That's a farce I like quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I believe black comedy. Peter Schaffer's black comedy. It's so hard to believe the guy who wrote black comedy wrote Amadeus at Equus, but I mean, he did. And so I enjoy those two because I believe what's happening. Here I can't believe it. So as a result, it loses me right away. Oh, and by the way, our director is not above adding some farts to the show, too, which are not in the script. Last night when there was a good deal of farting going on in one scene, I immediately stopped watching the show. I had a good seat. The lights and farce, of course, are always up at the top level, so I had enough to be able to see what's going on. They give you a script when you go to paper mill, and I went looking, and I'm telling you, there's nothing about gas being expelled in that show. So it's a little more vulgar here than it was in New York.
I couldn't remember. Thanks for clearing that up. But, it, you know, because I thought, I don't I don't know if I remember that in the Broadway production, but on the other hand, there's all that setup, Peter, about the sauerkraut.
I understand. I know that's supported. I understand that. But also, you know, God, look what we're talking about. We've all had experiences where we've eaten food that might give us this condition, but boy, do we work hard to make sure it doesn't happen. And, you know, it was just, I understand that. I don't disagree with that.
Oh, no, I'm just saying that because the setup was there, I thought that maybe I just didn't remember properly because it seemed like the setup was definitely leading to something.
I hear you. Yeah. Yeah, it's so funny. I remember George Carlin in the 70s talking about the fact that, gee, how come nobody ever farts on TV? You know, I mean, Archie Bunker, you know, should let out one once in a while and either should complain. And be careful what you wish for. I mean, that Roseanne TV episode that opened the door for this, you know, boy, it's really epidemic now, the whole thing with farting. So,
and don't forget Blazing Saddles.
Yes, that's fair. Yeah, Blazing Saddles predated Roseanne. Yeah, but you know that one. You know, it's sort of like, boy, I don't believe I'm going to bring in Showboat in Oklahoma here. It was like Showboat was innovative than Oklahoma was, and you know, it took Oklahoma for people to notice the innovations. Similarly speaking, Blazing Saddles didn't start an epidemic of farting, but the later Roseanne really did. Suddenly, it was everywhere, and it hasn't stopped at all. And I can't disagree that it's a human condition, and yes, it is a product of sauerkraut and all the rest that goes with that. But I don't need to get used to it, frankly. You know, I just don't. So.
Well, I tend to agree with you. And yes, every word you said about the believability of the play is absolutely true. You know, I don't know. I guess it's funny because usually that kind of stuff drives me up the wall.
Oh, yeah.
But I guess I just go in saying, well, this, what I'm about to see is going to have nothing to do with any kind of real human behavior.
Well, frankly, you know, when Boing Boing was announced as a British hit a few years ago and it was coming to Broadway, I was really up for it. You know, I have to say that when it tried out in Boston in 1965, I was living there, but, you know, I had to save, I was still a kid and saving my pennies, you know, was a hard thing. And I missed a lot of tryouts, and that was one that tried out there. And when I saw it at the Long Acre with Mark Rylance, I have to tell you that show was over for me 14 seconds after the curtain was raised, because when I saw that set, I said, this is the wrong set for farce. It was half a cylinder. It wasn't tight. It wasn't chock-a-block with things. So when the curtain went up last night, I was enthusiastic because the paper mill set has no relation to the Broadway set at all. I'm not saying it's a brilliant set. It's a conventional-looking set. But the point is, it does have a few obfuscations. There are tables. There are beanbag chairs. There's even one of those stands with a globe, you know, that type of thing. And so there's a lot of stuff that you have to maneuver around. I was talking to Court Watson, the set designer, recently, who brought up an excellent point that these are the things you never think of when you're not working on a certain thing in theater. And he was saying, you know, when you do a farce and you're set designing, you have to really determine how many steps there are going to be, because everything involves timing, you know, and you really have to make sure you don't put in too few or too many steps. And that's something you really have to work out. And what a fascinating observation. You know, that's something that doesn't occur to the layperson.
Right.
You know, why would he think of that? But it really is a very good point. So I wonder, I suspect the Broadway production of 1965 had a set with nooks and crannies and what have you to make things maneuver it a little more difficult, but it was too easy. There was virtually nothing on stage in the Broadway revival a few years ago, and so there wasn't stuff to maneuver around, which made it less funny. Yes, I have to say Brennan was very good at the split second timing. Boy, I'm telling you, the second the door closed, the other one opened. I mean, it was really good in that regard, and I'm sure they worked very, very hard on that. So while I'm not crazy about the direction of the show, I blame Boing more for anything else. So
yeah, and you know that thing you said about just to make the point of what you said about people not being able to hear what's going on in the main room, even though people are screaming. Yeah, that kind of. There were several points when I said, come on. And well, especially since, I don't know if you remember, but there is one point where John Shearer is in another room and and something, you know, people are screaming out front, and then he comes out and he's obviously heard what has just happened. So, all right. So like one time the person in the room hears it and every other time nobody does, you know, that's just silly, but that's the playwriting.
Yeah. Well, and it's also, you know, I mean, there are people who can suspend their disbelief, and much more obviously than I can. And the woman I took to see it last night, you know, was saying, it's only a play, you know, and I said to her, okay, but you know, you're not laughing that much. And I guarantee you, if the believability factor were better, you would be laughing more. What's preventing you from laughing is that you don't really buy it, not deep in your soul. And I do think that's a problem. For me, the best comedy is true comedy.
I do also think, though, that, and you may disagree, but I think a lot of it is that the central situation is so distasteful.
What is nice, though, he does have a line where he says, you know, something like, I adore all of them. And that mitigates it a little.
Yeah, but you know what? You know what would have really mitigated it? Well, it's so interesting because I said on the way home to my friend, I said, well, why didn't they just make it that he's not engaged to the three women? Why didn't they just make it that he's, you know, dating them? And then that would have made him, you know, seem like less of a cat. But my friend said, well, because it's the 60s and people and women wouldn't have stayed overnight with it with a man that they weren't married with. Now, I mean, one could argue it's Paris and, you know, their stewardess. But that's an interesting point.
It is, in fact. Ray Cooney, who's a fosseur, his play Run for Your Wife, which played on Broadway 20-odd years ago, is a play I've seen both in Rome and on Broadway. And what's so interesting about that play is it's about a guy who's a bigamist. All right, he is married to two women, and he's a taxi driver who works at night, and his wife accepts that he's working at night, and the other one thinks he has a day job and he works a day, and the other 8 hours he splits between both of them. And what's so nice about that play is that you really can tell that he did not want to break either woman's heart, that if he gave himself to one, she would be the other one would be devastated, and he just didn't have the heart to hurt them that way. And that's a very nice thing. At least it's not like this guy is Randy. I mean, this guy thinks he's beating the system. This guy is, even though he does say, I adore all of them, it's not as underlined as much as it is in Run for Your Wife. I can't believe I'm using Run for Your Wife as a model of dramaturgy here or something that's, you know, with a title like that, you know, I mean, really, I mean, do you know there was a play once in Britain called Let's Get Laid? A sex comedy. It was about a criminal whose name was Laid, and detectives said, let's get laid, you know, because they got to bring him in, you know, he's committed crimes. So, yeah, that was in the late 60s. So,
all right, well, we've devolved or evolved.
I guess, yeah.
Well, at least we rose from the fart jokes.
Yes.
Yes, we have. So a quick, we need to move on. We're running very late on Boeing, but I didn't see it. How does it play in the paper mill? It's such a small show in such a big house.
Well, I thought, and I know Peter is always the first to you know, to make mention of this, that I did think that there was a lot of laughter from the audience, regardless of what he or I may have thought.
Yeah.
So it was connecting, and I think they played it very, very big, probably bigger than they would have if it wasn't in that barn. So, and I, you know, I think they played it the way it needed to be played for that theater, you know, for better or worse. Here's an interesting thing. I was talking to the press agent, and I guess this isn't privileged information. He said that even though the ticket sales for whenever they do a play as opposed to a musical, the ticket sales are considerably less, but they still only make money on the plays because the production costs are so much less. So I thought that was an interesting little tidbit.
All right, let me say this about the audience last night and see if you agree with this, Michael. I thought that during the first act, there were giggles, there were chuckles. But then came the generous laughter and the guffawing in the second half. I thought it was far more sparse in the first act. And ideally, that's the way it should go in the sense that you want to build. It's much better to have it that way than the other way.
Right.
But nevertheless, I didn't think they were with it like crazy from the first moment.
I agree. And I also think that a lot of it was thanks to Beth Level, that she really she really reined them into that. She really brought everyone into that show with her. You didn't mention her hilarious French accent.
Yeah,
you know, it's so over the top, but it's absolutely hysterical. She says she does get laughs just by the way she pronounces syllables. You know,
yeah, it's very Marie Chevalier,
right? So God love her for that, because honestly, if it wasn't for that, it would have been a real long slog through the exposition part of the play.
And while I love Christine Baranski, I really thought Beth Lovell was far superior.
Yes, I would agree.
All right, so why don't we move on to The Road to Mecca, which is playing at with Roundabout at the American Airlines Theater. Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
Ethel Fugard's a rather quiet playwright in many respects. There's not much action in this play. There's a lot of dialogue, and they're really character studies. And I was worried about this play playing for the Roundabout audience. But the one thing it does have that is not irrelevant to the Roundabout audience, which is known to be very heavy with senior citizens, is the fact that it does deal with a woman who's aging and is occasionally forgetting things and doing things a little wrong here and there. And now there's an issue about whether or not she should be shuffled off to an old age home. And while watching it, I thought, hey, you know, this is something that obviously is going to strike a chord with many members of the Roundabout audience. So it seemed to be a good choice in that respect. And I felt my audience was very attentive watching it and were very drawn into the story. Jim Dale is a pastor of a local church, and they run this old age home, and they're looking for bodies, I'm telling you. And he's giving her all the official reasons why this will be the greatest thing that ever happened to her, and it's all for the best, and we're only thinking of you and all that. And it's nice to see her rebel. There's one moment where you think she's going to sign the paper, and I'm telling you, you're just heartbroken, and it doesn't quite happen. So Rosemary Harris, you know, in Goldman's book, The Season, which was about the 1967-68 season, he has a line that's something like, when you're doing a play, you automatically go to the three Harris girls, Barbara, Julie, or Rosemary. Well, Barbara won't act anymore. Julie can't act anymore. But here's Rosemary still doing it. And what's terrific about it is the fact that she's playing a very different character. This is a real down hope type woman who wears a sweater and has her hands in her pockets at all time. It's by no means a glamorous character. She comes from perhaps a middle-class ordinary background, and in playing an ordinary woman, Rosemary Harris is able to make her extraordinary. Yes, Ethel Fugard has something to do with that too. And what's nice about the character as well is she has a very good friend. All right, think about it. She has a friend. Who's in your mind now as the friend? No, it's a young woman. And that's what's so nice about it, that she has enough appeal that young people want to be around her. And this woman who visits her is a dear friend. At first, you think it's her daughter. You just do. Because, you know, why is an old woman with a younger woman? Well, it must be her daughter. This is a visit that the daughter has to make. No, that's what's so wonderful. It's not that type of visit at all. It's not obligation. It's not a birthday or a holiday where the son or daughter has to show up or else get in trouble. No. This woman, the young woman, is concerned about her. She loves her dearly, and for good reason. It's not hard to love Rosemary Harris. She really makes her a very endearing character. Jim Dale, I think, is very good. By the way, this has got to be the first time in a long time that when curtain calls come, that Jim Dale gets the first curtain call, not the last. I mean, usually he's the star of the show, but he actually gets the first curtain call, partly because he doesn't come in until virtually the second act. But I think he's very good too in trying to put it across that he only has her welfare at heart and really masking the fact that he has his own venal reasons. So, and Carla Gugino, very, very nice as the young woman who has a struggle whether or not she should get involved with these two people. She certainly has opinions, but part of the thing is that she believes Rosemary Harris is a fully actualized woman and has the right to make her own decision. So should she be preventing her from going to the old age home if indeed Rosemary Harris makes the decision to do it? So there's more tension here than meets the eye, and I found it a very good revival.
Michael, what'd you think?
That was a wonderful thing you said about Miss Harris. Thank you for saying that. She really is a treasure. If that needs to be said, and her last role was very different. The royal family,
sure.
As you said, that was much more glamorous, if you will. This is polar opposite, but a beautiful performance. And this production would be worth seeing for that reason alone. I went into the play cold. I had never seen or read it before, which I like to do sometimes, you know.
You bet.
And I was surprised by a few things. It has almost nothing to do with apartheid, which is, I think almost every other Few Guard play is much more directly concerned with apartheid. This is about it more obliquely. It's more about self-expression. The Rosemary Harris character is a woman who has always been kind of looked askance at by a lot of people because she creates these wonderful sculptures and artworks that people don't quite know what to make of. And so that's part of the plot, is that she's always been sort of a free spirit, and some people have always wondered what was up with her. But I have to say, Jim Dale was excellent, and because when he comes on, the plot really kicks in. Mm-hmm. I was surprised at how extremely poorly the exposition of the play was written by a major playwright like Adolf Fugard. I don't know if people brought this up when it originally premiered, but it seems like endless exposition. The Carla Gugino, I think that's how you pronounce her name, I'm not sure.
Uh-huh.
Her character comes on, and after having driven for hours to visit her friend, and they reminisce, and it seems like they talk for an hour reminiscing and just telling us about all these things that happened in their past and the people that they knew, and oh, do you remember when this happened, and do you remember when that happened? Now, up to a point, it's very interesting and charming, especially when you have actresses like Carla Gugino and Rosemary Harris. But after a while, my eyes were glazing over, and I know several people, that I know who saw the show either on that night or other nights made comments about dozing off.
It does get off to a slow start.
And it's sad, because I think that so much of that material is just really quite superfluous. This may be heresy, but if I were ever to want to direct it, I would try, actually, and if I had permission, I would cut about 15 or 20 minutes from it, because I think it becomes diminishing returns after a while. All of this exposition, I mean, the points are made and that's great, and you get the relationship, and then the points are made again and again. And that was really surprising to me, because that should be something that a major playwright should be able to handle exposition better than that. But
it's funny you mentioned. Oh, sorry.
Once it does get going, and once Jim Dale comes on, I at that point I found it really tremendously involving and very, very compelling to see what was going to happen. Part of the reason being that the Jim Dale character is very complex. It takes a while for you to figure out exactly how self-serving he's being or not. And I think even in the end, there's some question.
I agree.
So that's a very good, I think mm-hmm. that's very good playwriting, and the suspense aspect as to whether or not she's going to, allow herself to be put into this old age home is also very good. So I just, I just wish that it didn't have what I view as a really, really major flaw in the first 45 minutes of it.
You know, it's funny you mentioned the apartheid issue. The first Fugard play I ever saw was in 1969, which was a play called Hello and Goodbye. I was working for a newspaper called Boston After Dark, which has morphed into the Boston Phoenix, which is essentially the Village Voice of Boston. And they sent me down to Paramus, New Jersey, at a theater in the mall, which is no longer there, to see this play, because the following week it was going to be in Boston. And it was only going to be there for a little while, and they wanted to get the review in fast. So I went to Paramus, saw the play, and came back and wrote a review. But then the producer, Kermit Bloomgarden, no less, decided, no, I'm not going to bring it to Boston. He went right to New York. So all that was for nothing. But the reason I bring this up is in the playbill, it mentioned then in 1969 that Athol Fugard, at that moment in time, was in jail. He was jailed for the apartheid issue. And when I was reading this, I assumed I was reading about a black man.
Right.
You know,
right.
Because how many white people get that involved with racial issues to the point of which they're willing to go to jail over it? Yeah. And so years later, when I learned that he was a white man, I was mightily impressed. I've interviewed him a number of times because he's at a lot of shows at the MacArthur Theater in Princeton. He is such a nice guy and, needless to say, a heroic one for being willing to put himself on the line like that to actually spend time in jail.
Yes, and I should say, you know, so as not to appear to come down too hard on him, Master Harold and the Boys, to me, is a truly great play.
I agree.
And in that case, I mean, you know, almost every play requires some degree of exposition, and certainly that one does. I mean, you need to find out what the relationship was between Harold and these mm-hmm. two black men, and mm-hmm. and his father, who is off stage only on mm-hmm. a phone and never appears. I think it's handled masterfully in that case. So I'm not sure, and I'm not actually sure where these two plays fall in the chronologically. Do you know offhand, Peter?
I certainly know that. Master Harold was produced on Broadway in 81 and Road to Mecca was 83, I believe. So, but I'm not sure if we got either one of them late. You know,
oh, okay. Yeah.
You know, I don't know when they were written necessarily, but certainly 81 was the Broadway production of Master Harold.
Well, my point is that if you want to see, if you want to a play to study in a playwriting course, to see sheer brilliance and to see how things like exposition can be handled so beautifully, that would be an excellent choice. And so it surprised me that this one, in my opinion, was not you know, as well written in that respect.
It's occurred to me, actually, it had to be 82, because I remember Lonnie Price was in it in 1981, late 81. He was busy at the Alvin Theater with Merrily We Roll Along until the 28th of November. So so it was the spring of 82. It was that season, 81-82 season. So I do recall that.
And by the way, there is hopefully it still existed, I mentioned this recently, an amazing television version of Master Harold and the Boys with Matthew Broderick.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to try to track that down because I remember it being one of the greatest things I've ever seen.
How wonderful. You know? I've never seen it. I know of its existence.
Oh,
it's
wonderful.
Oh,
you know,
it's
Zakes Mokay,
uh-huh.
Who I believe created the role, I think it's Danny Glover.
Danny Glover, yeah,
yeah. So yeah, check that out, Peter. It's amazing.
And of course, that's become before Danny Glover became a megastar in action movies. You know,
All right. So before we talk about our final show, which is Picture Box. I wanted to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com. And on the right-hand side, there's a Broadway Radio section. In that section, there's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time there's a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you, so you won't miss anything. If you want to listen to us in another way, you can get us through the Stitcher app. That's Stitcher, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry device, your Android device, anything, and you can stream us and get us on the fly and not miss anything there as well. You could also listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m., and take a listen to us there. If you want to read the show notes and get links to the different things we talked about, you go to BroadwayRadio.com. And at BroadwayRadio.com, you can see the contact information for Peter, Michael, myself, and all the show notes as we talked about and links to different things that have happened. Michael, why don't you tell us about Picture Box at the Negro Ensemble Company?
Well, I really enjoyed it. I don't know a lot about, I don't know anything or next to nothing about the playwright Kate Ryan, that's C-A-T-E Ryan. And I believe that this is the first time that the Negro Ensemble Company has done anything at Theater Row. So I think that was great that they have, you know, kind of a more high-profile location for this play. It's a very short play. I think it's only about an hour and 15 minutes, with no intermission, obviously. And I, in this case, I guess it was sort of the opposite of what I said about Road to Mecca, in a way. The situation is that this middle-aged woman has come back to her mother's house following her mother's death, and she is cleaning out the house. And the African-American man who was the caretaker for the family still lives in the vicinity, and he comes over, and it's all about how he was basically a surrogate father for her because the mother was somewhat emotionally distant, and it's about their really wonderful loving relationship and everything they've been through, and it there was a lot of wonderful writing in it, but my heart sank when it started because the situation is that the house is about to be sold, and this white couple comes in. And they are like something out of, you know, I mean, the guy is Archie Bunker to the 12 millionth degree, but with none of the charm. He immediately starts in with these racial epithets because he's like, well, you know, there's that black neighborhood, like right next door. You know, I mean, you know, we have to be afraid of those people coming here and, you know, still. And it was so over the top and so blunt and so caricatured and ridiculous that my heart really sank. But as soon as they left, those two, there was a lot of really wonderful writing in the scenes between Jennifer Van Dyke, who played the woman, the daughter who's selling the house, and Arthur French, the wonderful veteran actor who played the caretaker. And so I think that the play showed a lot of promise, and I hope that to see more from Kate Ryan and that she, you know, maybe we'll consider that one doesn't need to write caricatures like that in order to make a point.
All righty. Just one thing in the news that I just want to touch on for just a minute because we're running very late is that Follies closed last weekend, and we come with the news that Folly closed at a loss.
My buddy Mark Miller said one of the wittiest things when he talked about Bialystok and Bloom. You know, he said, you know, they're there, they're putting on a show that has to fail. Why don't they just produce Follies? I mean, nobody ever expects it's going to make any money, so why not just do that? You know, and I love that remark. I guess we always have to settle for
a hard to get ticket, and yet we couldn't turn a profit there.
But you know, to bring this full circle in a way, God love, to use Peter's expression, God love the Kennedy Center for doing the production in the first place, and for them bringing it to Broadway, because like it or not, and aside from everything else we said, I'm convinced that one of the main reasons that Porgy and Bess was produced the way it was just as a money-saving, well, I mean, it was produced in order to create a new form of the show to be licensed, because the show is going into public domain fairly soon. But But having done that, I mean, the changes that were made for this production, a lot of them simply have to do with cutting corners and pinching pennies. The orchestra was much smaller than it should have been, and certainly much smaller than the orchestra for Follies. The cast size was reduced greatly. The set, as we've pointed out, was not anywhere near as detailed and useful as it could have been, and one could go on and on. So, you know, downsizing is clearly the general move in theater today. And of course, you know, I mean, of course you can't blame people in a sense. I mean, nobody wants to lose money, and they still want to do things. And, but
well, Michael, your good friend, Gerard Alessandrini, wrote a parody called Teeny Todd many, many years ago.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I think that there's always been a push to make things smaller and more profitable, and it is called show business. Ooh. But you know, God love the Kennedy Center. And God love the people who donate money to the Kennedy Center so that the Kennedy Center can do those things, because certainly ticket prices don't pay for those things.
No, and of course this gave people who have never seen Follies, people too young to have seen the original or even the Roundabout Revival for that matter, the chance to check this one off their list, which is, if you're a musical theater enthusiast, is on your list of something you have to see. And yes, we can all quarrel about this, that, and the other thing involving this production, but the bottom line is that in many ways it was a first-class production. And as a result, we should be grateful that it came to us.
And one thing that it does, you know, it helped in its own small way, or, you know, I mean, it's like trying to stave off the tide, but it, in giving audiences the chance to hear what a full orchestra sounds like, playing that music like that, and without ridiculous over-amplification, it does help to get that sound into people's ear and keep it alive, because part of the reason that that producers are getting away with having eight-piece orchestras is that people aren't used to the sound as much as they were back in the day, and there's not music education in schools and blah, 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 blah. And this, you know, is a really sad thing, I think. And so thanks to them for that aspect of it specifically.
Hey, I forgot to ask before, and we got to go really quickly here. Has anybody heard any rumors about a Porgy and Bess cast recording?
No, not I.
Yeah, I was wondering, because somebody in an email to me today just said in passing something about I don't think I'm going to get the album or something like that, but I don't know if they meant that they had read anything, because I don't recall.
I sort of just assume with Audra and a big production and things like that they would do that. But all right, and to wrap it up, the final thing that we're going to mention tonight is that if you are not doing something on Wednesday evening,
oh, good for you.
January 25th, I have a card game. No. There is going to be a reading of Prompt and Adam, which is a another view of A Christmas Carol. Isn't that, Peter?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. It's
7
going
o'clock.
To be at St. Luke's, 308
West 46th. Jim Brochu, Maureen Silliman, David Schmidto, Stacey Lentz, and Matthew Gumley. Five characters, Christmas Carol. Yeah, it'd be nice to see you there. Nice to shake your hands.
Please stop by. Say hello to Peter. Say hello to me if I'm trying to make my schedule work so I can make it. And we would it'd be great to see it. And, you know, again, I marvel at, you know, I think that there are actually three or four Peter Felicias, because I don't know where you have the time to do all this stuff. So writing 24/7, seeing shows, writing books, and writing plays. So something we should all aspire to. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, who's probably already gone writing something else right now, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radios This Week on Broadway. Take care.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Never worry long as well. Never one to strive to be good, to be bad. What the hell? as glad as a lark. Oh, I got plenty of nothing, and nothing's plenty for me. I got my gal, I got my song, got him the whole day long.